Okay, so we're going to talk about Mashiach. We're going to Bezrat Hashem talk about a very important topic, and I guess that's why we're having difficulty because there's a lot of opposition to bringing the Geula. So let's jump right into our topic. A person who's looking forward to something, anyone who's longing for something, anticipating something. It could be something major. It could be something minor. When my son says to me, Moshe Tzvi, or he says, Daddy. Can you come here? I need to speak to you. Can you help me with something? I'm building a fort in the den like he was doing yesterday with his blankets and his pillows. And I said, Yaakov, I'll be with you in just a minute. So for a young boy, waiting a minute is sometimes a hard concept. What is a minute? Is a minute 1 second? Is a minute a minute? Is a minute an hour? We sometimes, when we talk about time, when we say something will arrive shortly, right? It used to be that the notion of a package arriving shortly was a certain period of time. Today, shortly means within 24 hours, or if I send someone a text message or I leave a make a phone call, I expect a response almost immediately, right? And the notion of anticipating something and waiting for something, sometimes there's a disconnect in the conversation. The same thing is true with us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says Mashiach is going to come soon, and we say, well, soon means soon, and Hashem, in a certain sense, responds to us by way of David HaMelech and Tehillim, ki elef shanim be'einecha ki yom etmo, which means that what for us feels like 1,000 years, for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, could be just yesterday, could be a single day. So there's a level of disconnect between us and Hashem, in a certain sense, when we feel like we've been waiting a really long time for Mashiach. From Hashem's perspective, perhaps it's not quite as long, but certainly throughout history, the pain and the suffering that we felt at various points of Jewish history, where we got motivated, we were excited, we were anticipating Mashiach's imminent arrival. And then there was some type of particularly painful setback, can be very, very damaging. And therefore Chazal, if you look at the sources, we'll get to the sources in just a moment for those who are able to download them. Chazal were very, very critical of individuals who tried to predict Mashiach's arrival. And it's understood why. Because if you're expecting something by a particular date, and then that date is delayed, so the pain of that experience could be somewhat depressing. There's a fellow in my neighborhood right around the corner who's in the midst of doing construction on his home. And he told me the house should be ready, God willing, by the beginning of July. So now we're into the month of July, and he still hasn't moved in with his family yet. And I said, what's with the house? So he told me, oh, the contractor said another couple of weeks. And we all know this experience, another couple of weeks, another couple of weeks. When a person is anticipating something, the same is true when a person is going through a medical condition and the doctor predicts, there's a fellow in my neighborhood who was badly injured his leg a number of years ago, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months. Again, that hope, that anticipation of something arriving and the frustration when that doesn't become one's reality is very crushing. And therefore, again, Chazal were very, very critical of predictions of Mashiach. If you look in the first of the sources, a pasuk in the second chapter of Habakkuk, ki od chazon lamoed, there is yet a vision of an appointed time. Ve'afeach laketz v'lo yechazev. It speaks of the ketz, it speaks of the end of days, it speaks of the redemption. V'lo yechazev, and it's not tricking you, it's not deceiving you, it's telling the truth. Yet nonetheless, we're not sure exactly when that is. And therefore, im yitmamea chakelo, if it should tarry, or if Mashiach, if he should tarry, if he delays, wait for him. Continue to wait. Ki vo yavo lo ye'acher, because it will surely come true, and it will not delay. In other words, the pasuk is telling us, it's incumbent upon us to continue to long for Mashiach, and even if from your perspective it seems that Mashiach is running behind schedule, continue to wait, continue to wait, continue to be patient. Certainly all of the prophecies will eventually come true. But the Gemara comments in Maseches Sanhedrin in the second of our sources this morning, and Daf Tzadi Zayin Amud Beis, Ma'ay v'yafeach laketz v'lo yechazev. Amar Rav Shmuel Bar Nachmani, Amar Rav Yonasan, Tipach Atzman Shem Machashvei Kitzen. Wow, very strong words. May the bones rot. May the essence of the individuals who predict Mashiach's arrival be overturned. Shayu Omrim, and here's the danger, Chazal, we're very explicit about what the danger is. Imagine I told you, I guarantee, I swear to you, I promise you, Mashiach is coming today. I guarantee you will not go to sleep tonight without greeting Mashiach's arrival. Right? And God forbid that prediction does not come true. So you become despondent. You become depressed. You feel that you've been deceived. You feel that you've been fed information which is utterly false. So there's such a danger, say Chazal, while there's a temptation to want to predict Mashiach's arrival, to interpret world events, to look at the verses of Tanakh and try to find indications of when Mashiach is coming, there's such a grave danger that, God forbid, that time will arrive, Mashiach will not yet arrive, and a person will say, Shuv Eino Ba, maybe Mashiach's never going to come. And therefore, Chazal were very critical and told us, focus on the latter part of that pasuk, which is, Im Yismama Chakelo. If Mashiach will tarry, if Mashiach will delay, continue to wait for Mashiach. Actually, in the Maseches Derech Eretz, which is one of the Masechtos Ketanos, in source number 3, the language of Chazal is even firmer, is even stronger. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Hanosein Esaket, Ein Lo Chelek LiOlam Haba. A person, again, who gives indications that this is when, the definitive time of Mashiach's arrival, such a person can lose their portion in the world to come. And that's not a category that any of us want to end up in. The Rambam, of course, records this lahalacha in Hilchos Malachim in source number 4 and encourages us. The Rambam says, as I've told you before, continue to wait for Mashiach. Don't lock yourself into a particular understanding of when Mashiach is going to be or what Mashiach is going to be. Just continue to long for Mashiach's arrival in a general sense. So we see that Chazal are very clear. The Rambam records this lahalacha. And now we raise the following question, which is really quite remarkable. And that is that throughout history, many, many, many tzaddikim and great Jewish leaders throughout the generations offered predictions of Mashiach. In fact, the very Rambam, who just paskened, who just ruled in accordance with Jewish law, that it is absolutely forbidden to offer predictions of Mashiach's arrival, how ironic it is that the Rambam, Maimonides himself, in his Igeres Teiman, predicts the arrival of Mashiach sometime around the 13th century, the beginning of the 13th century, somewhere in the early 1200s. He says, I have a family tradition, it goes back generations. And he offers a prediction. And the tzaddikim are very busy throughout the generation looking at those cryptic verses in the 12th chapter of Daniel. Kila moed, moedim, vachetzi, a time, and times, and half a time, trying to figure out how to calculate that. So it's not surprising to us that we run into this conflict. On the one hand, we have a very clear indication from Chazal that this is a prohibited practice, and yet some of our greatest sages were involved in it. And it's quite ironic. It's quite surprising. So what are we to make? And this is the question I want to think about. What are we to make of all the predictions that we have seen throughout Jewish history? How are we to understand them? How is it not a violation on the most simple level? How is it not a violation of halacha? Were these tzaddikim not concerned, again, about the svara, the logical explanation that Chazal offer, the fear of creating this religious fervor, this excitement for something which is not actually going to arrive? It's such a danger. Think about Shabtai Tzvi and so many other false messianic movements and how it led people astray and crushed their hopes. It's such a great danger. So how do we make sense of the tzaddikim offering predictions throughout the generations? So I want to offer a few explanations. I don't know that any of them is, they're certainly not mutually exclusive, and I'm not sure that any of them will be satisfying to you. But by way of explanation, I'll offer a couple of explanations that I've seen over the years. There was a great Jew by the name of Rav Reuven Margolius. Rav Reuven Margolius passed away in 1971. Unfortunately, he died childless. He was an unbelievable Torah scholar. He wrote over 60 volumes of Torah literature in really every area of Torah. And he spent the last 35 years of his life in a very quiet and somewhat unassuming way as the librarian in the Rambam Library in Tel Aviv. Really a tremendous Talmud Chacham, well known for his Margolius Hayam, his commentary on Maseches Sanhedrin. And he raises this question. If the Gemara tells us that it's absolutely prohibited in very strong language, is prohibited to predict Mashiach's arrival, so why did so many people do it? So he offers, perhaps as a defense, as long as one does not offer a definitive date, as long as I don't get up and declare that I guarantee that today is the day of Mashiach's arrival, as long as I speak in general terms that I believe, I have reason to believe that perhaps this is an auspicious time, there are indications that this might be a time, and therefore we should get ourselves a little bit more ready, but I'm not by any way guaranteeing that today is the particular date, that the definitive date of Mashiach's arrival, perhaps then it's okay. So an explanation in defense of all the people throughout the generations who offered predictions. And by the way, it spans basically every century of Jewish history. You can find dates indicating that Mashiach is going to come. Again, the Rambam predicted the earliest part of the 13th century. And we have predictions in very recent times. Again, written dates that were recorded in Sfarim of people who are alive in our time, and certainly predictions of people who are no longer alive, indicating particular dates. But says Reuben Margolius, if you want to attempt a date, as long as it's clear that this is not the definitive date, then it's okay. Okay, so it could be that when the Rambam shared his family tradition that somewhere around the year 1216, Mashiach is going to arrive, he wasn't saying that I'm guaranteeing it. I don't know for sure. I have a family tradition dating back to Yerushalayim, the Rambam writes, and he was trying to inspire people to give them hope, while at the same time, hopefully, cautiously, reminding them that this is not the absolute definitive date. Okay, so a possible defense. Again, we would have to assume that throughout the generations, the dates that were indicated were only set as a speculation and not as a definitive date. Okay, it could be, but let's try to go a little bit further. There's a wonderful volume, and the art site of this tzaddik is coming up soon. One of the great teachers of Hasidus, one of the great rebbes of Hasidus, was the Choza of Lublin, the seer of Lublin, whose yard site actually falls out on Tisha B'Av, which we hope this year will be a day of celebration. And in a volume printed called Avnei Zikaron in source number 5, he offers the following explanation. There's a halacha in Yaradeya that tells us that if a child sees a parent doing something improper, you're not allowed to correct the parent. If a child knows that a particular thing is not permitted on Shabbos and the parent is doing that thing which is against the halacha, a child cannot say, "Mom, you're wrong. Dad, you're wrong. You can't do that." It's a violation of kibud av va'em. It's a disrespectful way to speak to a parent. At the same time, we know that Hashem's honor trumps the honor of parents. So what is the proper way to inform a parent that they're doing something improper? And the halacha tells us that you're supposed to, in a roundabout way, in a gentle way, suggest, "Oh, Mom, Dad, I saw the Mishnah Berurah says that you're supposed to do like this," or "Doesn't it say?" or "Didn't I once learn?" To almost ask it as a question, and not to offer it again as a declaration that you're doing something wrong, but to try to, in the way of learning, to try to suggest, "Mom, Dad, I was just reading this book, and it says here that it's prohibited to do this on Shabbos," without an attack, and without directly pointing out that that individual who happens to be your parent is doing something wrong. So the Choz of Lublin offered the following suggestion. He said it could be that perhaps when the tzaddikim throughout the generation were offering predictions, they were really speaking more to Hashem. They were opening up the Chumash and they were saying, "Hashem, I see in Parshas Balak the following indication. Hashem, my Father in heaven, maybe you have a different way of reading the Pasuk. But couldn't one suggest that the Pasuk in the 12th chapter of Daniel could be read like this or like that?" And it was a delicate way of, so to speak, reminding Hashem of the promise of Mashiach. Again, it's a clever of art. It's a cute idea. It's a nice way to try to remind HaKadosh Baruch Hu of the promises he made to us through the Torah and through the Nevi'im and through the Ksuvim. But at the end of the day, it hasn't worked. Because here we are in the year 2020, Tafshin Pei. And we're still sitting here and we're still waiting, anticipating the redemption. So obviously hinting to Hashem has not worked to allow HaKadosh Baruch Hu to bring the redemption quite yet. I want to talk for a moment again about that feeling of loss. When a prediction takes place and it doesn't become the reality, and just how painful that is. One of the great volumes of literature, of post-Holocaust literature, of course, is Viktor Frankl's 1946 best-selling work, Man's Search for Meaning. If you haven't read it, you should. He recounts his experience in Auschwitz, and he really lays out his philosophy for living, a tremendous psychological approach to finding meaning in the greatest suffering. And it's really a remarkable work that's been translated into many, many languages. And on page 97 of Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, he tells the following story, a personal account, that happened to him when he was in Auschwitz. He said he had a friend who prior to the war was a well-known composer, a musician, a lyricist, and he told him, this fellow told him, as they were suffering in a concentration camp, February 1945, he told them that I had a dream. And in my dream, it was revealed to me that on March 30th, precisely March 30th, we are going to be liberated. We're finally going to be granted our freedom once again. And Viktor Frankl saw how excited this fellow was, how vivid this dream was, how the anticipation of that possible redemption was so real to him. But Viktor Frankl describes as that day approached, he saw that his friend was losing his hope because liberation was nowhere in sight at that point for these individuals. And he saw that his prophecy wasn't coming true. And he noticed and he records, he tells the story again in his book, how on March 29th, the day before the predicted date, his friend, this fellow, developed a very high fever. By March 30th, the day that he anticipated his personal liberation, his personal redemption, when that prophecy didn't come true, he fell delirious and lost consciousness. And by March 31st, the next day, the fellow was dead. And Viktor Frankl writes, and again, if you have the source sheet, it's in front of you in source number 6. To those who know how close the connection is between the state of mind of a man, his courage and hope, or lack of them, and the state of immunity of his body will understand that sudden loss of hope and courage can have a deadly effect. In other words, Viktor Frankl says, unfortunately, I was not surprised to see this happen. Because, and this again, this is the whole premise of his book, that if I have something to live for, that if I have something to put my hope and my trust in, then I can survive anything. But when everything that I've invested in is all lost, this fellow went all in on that particular date, March 30th, 1945. And when that hope was crushed, so it took a devastating toll on his physical body, on his physical well-being. The sudden loss of hope and courage can have a deadly effect, he writes. The ultimate cause of my friend's death was that the expected liberation did not come, and he was severely disappointed. In other words, as he goes on to say, he didn't die of typhus. Maybe that's what a doctor's report would say. But his faith in the future and his will to live had become paralyzed, and his body fell victim to illness. And thus the voice of his dream was right after all. What a painful line to write. That in fact, he did experience his liberation on or around March 30th, unfortunately in the form of death, and not in the freedom that he had hoped for. One of the great dates that was offered throughout the generations that was spoken about prior to this date, and certainly as this date got closer, was the year 1860. There was tremendous, tremendous hope. Again, a lot has been written about the year 1860 as a year that was ripe for redemption, a time that was hopeful for Geula based on an interpretation of a passage in the Zohar. And many, many tzaddikim of that time period were sharing thoughts of hope, of inspiration, trying to rally people to do tshuva, trying to get people excited about that possibility of the year 1860 being that year of redemption. And there was one very well-known tzaddik, known as Rav Eliezer of Jikov. Rav Eliezer of Jikover, who was the son of Rav Naftali of Rapshitz. Again, those who are familiar with the Tzaddikim of Chassidus will be familiar with some of these names. The third son of the Rapshitzer, the holy Jikover, got up and declared in the year 1860, I guarantee Mashiach is not coming. And everyone else was talking about Mashiach's arrival. And no one could understand, why is the Jikover opposing Mashiach? I mean, The indication of the Zohar, 1860, is a time of an opening up of a new world order. Everyone was longing, everyone was hoping. And yet somehow Rav Eliezer of Jikov opposed this hopefulness. Why was that so? And Rav Eliezer declared, and I saw this in a volume, an English volume called the Encyclopedia of Hasidism, on page 219 in source number 7. Many people believed that the Messiah would come in 1860. A belief based on a reference in the Zohar, as we just mentioned. In 1860, during the festival of Sukkot, Rebbe Eliezer publicly affirmed the Mashiach would not come. Later, he explained the motive for his negative statement. And listen to this, it's so important. Better that people should lose faith in me and accuse me of telling lies than they should lose faith in the coming of Mashiach. In other words, Rebbe Eliezer of Jikov said, what's going to happen if all the tzaddikim, if everyone predicts Mashiach's arrival in 1860, and God forbid Mashiach doesn't come, so then they're going to say, Klal Yisrael is going to say, we've been deceived. Our rabbis have lied to us. The predictions are wrong. The Zohar is incorrect. It would be such a crushing blow to Klal Yisrael. So the Jikover, at risk of great personal, he also thought 1860 was a year for Mashiach. But he said, I'd prefer Mashiach to come in 1860, and people call me a charlatan, and say he's not really a tzaddik, he's not really a Talmud Chacham, I'd rather that then God forbid everyone to predict Mashiach's arrival. And if Mashiach doesn't come, then God forbid what's going to be the state of Klal Yisrael. And therefore he said, I'm going to take the opposite position. Just as a safety precaution, you understand how dangerous it is for us to have all of that messianic fervor. And therefore, when Mashiach didn't come in the year 1860, as obviously we know, we're sitting here today, Mashiach has yet to arrive. So then when people would say, well, everyone predicted 1860, we could respond and we could say, not everyone predicted 1860. Rabbi Eliezer of Jikov did not predict 1860. The Malbim, one of the great staunch defenders of traditional Orthodox Judaism. Of course, the Malbim wrote extensively in Nach. The Malbim was a tremendous Talmid Chacham in all areas of Torah. We have a little bit of his writings in Halacha as well. He was a Kabbalist as well. Again, we think of the Malbim as a great teacher of Tanakh, which he was, but he was much more than that as well. And the Malbim, in his commentary on Sefer Daniel, offers a calculation for Mashiach's arrival as the year 1913. Now, obviously, with a little sense of world history, we all understand that shortly thereafter, World War I arrived in the world. It would last 4 years and take 16 million lives. So certainly something big was brewing in the world at the time. I once read, and again, I don't know exactly what the source for this is. It could be it's an apocryphal tale, but it certainly makes the point. I once read that someone challenged the Malbim. They asked the Malbim directly. They asked the Malbim, Rav Meir Leibush, they said to him, you know, you offer a prediction in your writings. You predict that Mashiach is coming in the year 1913. Again, he passed away in 1879, so he didn't live to see his prediction, and that it would in fact lead to World War I. Again, certainly a ripe time for something to happen in the world. But the Malbim was asked in his lifetime, how could you offer predictions of Mashiach? After all, the Gemara has such strong opposition to offering predictions of Mashiach's arrival. And the Malbim responded with the following parable. He offered the following mashal. He said, imagine a father and a son who set out on a very lengthy journey. They're traveling, they're going a great distance. And imagine, you know, back in the day, they're traveling by horse and buggy. It's going to be a long, long journey. And the father takes his young son along for the journey. And they pull out of their driveway, so to speak, and they set out on this long journey. And about a minute and a half into the journey, the little son looks up to his father and he says, Tati, Abba, Dad, are we there yet? And the father says, Oy vey. If he's asking, are we there? We literally just started the journey. I mean, we're going to be on the road for weeks, if not months, right? And 3 seconds into the journey, he's already asking, are we there yet? Are we there yet? You can't, he says to his son, you can't ask that question. I'll let you know. I'll let you know when we're there. I can't have you pestering me the entire journey. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? After traveling for a very long period of time, they finally get close to their destination. And the father turns to the wagon driver and he says to the wagon driver, are we getting close? Are we almost there? And the son at this point turns to his father and says, Abba, Dad, Tati, you told me I shouldn't ask that question. You told me I'm not allowed to ask, are we there yet? And the father turns to his young son and he explains to him. He said, my dear son, at the beginning of the journey, it was improper to ask that question because we're so far away to ask, are we there yet? No, we're not even close to there yet. But as we get close to our final destination, it's okay for me to turn to the wagon driver and to ask at this point, how much farther? The question makes sense. It's an appropriate question. Said the Malbim when the Gemara wrote that it's prohibited for us to predict Mashiach's arrival. That was a long time ago. That was at the beginning of the journey. But now, says the Malbim again, who lived in the later part of the 19th century, says the Malbim, it's clear to me that we're getting close to the end of the journey. And now the conversation has to change. Now it's okay for us to start asking, so to speak, the driver to ask the Kadosh Baruch Hu, are we there yet? And to actually start predicting how soon we're going to arrive. Again, a beautiful mashal, but here we are more than 100 years after the Malbim's prediction, and we're still waiting. It pains me to share with you, but the Brisker Rav said that after the Holocaust, it could not be more than 70 years until Mashiach's arrival. Well, that date has come and passed as well. So again, we have a very dangerous historical precedent of predicting Mashiach. Again, on the one hand, it's coming from a good place. The Rambam, when he wrote in the 1200s, he was trying to machazek. He wrote it in his Igeres Teiman. He was trying to offer words of encouragement that Jews should hold on. Mashiach's right around the corner. And again, on the one hand, we all understand that desire to want to hope for something that the arrival is imminent. But at the same time, the danger is so obvious and so real to us. And therefore, I ask you, how are we to make sense of this complicated sugya? So I want to share with you a medrash, and in a certain sense, this is the essence of everything that I want to share with you. It's a medrash on the pasuk in Parshas Balak that we read not that long ago, a pasuk that itself is somewhat cryptic, but the medrash tells us it's really a question of perspective. So much of our life has to do with our perspective, and this medrash certainly highlights that point as well. Let's learn sources 12 and 13. Again, for those who have the source sheet in front of you, feel free to look inside. The pasuk in Balak says the following. Perek Chav Dalid of Chumash Bamidbar, Erenu velo ata. Erenu velo ata. We will yet see him velo ata, but not now. Ashurenu velo karov. These, of course, are the predictions of Bilam HaRasha. Bilam, who is seen in the language of our sages as being the greatest of the non-Jewish prophets. Erenu velo ata. Bilam says, I see him, but not now. I see something coming, but it's not happening quite yet. Ashurenu Velo karov. I can perceive something, but it's not close. Darach kochav miyakov. A star will rise from amongst the Jewish people. Vekam shevet miyisrael. Right? Again, it's a prediction of a messianic redeemer. But in the language of Bilam, Bilam is saying, it's not as close as you think. Says the Medrash, says the Yalkut Shimoni in Source 13, Erenu velo ata amar Rabbi Yitzchak. Moshe amar ki karov yom edam. Moshe Rabbeinu always spoke the language of karov. Moshe always spoke a language of closeness, that what you're hoping for is within reach. Moshe Rabbeinu tells Klal Yisrael, ki karov eilecha hadavar ma'od. One of the greatest challenges is for us to believe that there's a notion called tshuva, which allows me to what? To literally rewrite the script. I can fix something that I did yesterday. I can change a mistake that I made last month or last year. It seems like an impossibility. It's so hard to do tshuva. Says the pasuk Moshe Rabbeinu conveys to us in the Torah, ki karov alecha davar ma'od. Tshuva is within reach. Torah, living, is within reach. Moshe always spoke the language of karov. The downfall of our enemies is karov, ki karov yom edam. Bilam, on the other hand, always focused on the glass being what? Half empty. Bilam said, it's not as close as you think. It's not as realistic as you think. Bilam Amar Erenu, I also see it, velo ata, but it's not anywhere within reach. Mashal lemelech shenasan medina libino b'makom rachok. Says the Medrash, we can compare it to a king who offered his child, a prince, he offered him a palace in a distant land. And the prince was traveling to this faraway palace, being escorted by those who love him and those who despised him. As he was traveling this long distance, his jealous enemies turned to the prince and said to him, you know why your father gave you a portion so far away? It's because he doesn't like you. He wants you far away. He's trying to send you on this dangerous journey, maybe hoping you'll die and never even make it to the promised land. And the son was very depressed. The son of the king was very depressed. All of a sudden, his confidant, his friend, his advisor, the person who loves him turns to him and says to him, no, don't you understand? It's not true at all. It's true, it's a long journey. But how much more will you appreciate when you arrive at that Medina, when you come to that city, and you come to your palace, and you're greeted with all the ma'adane melech, all the greatest delicacies. Miyad niskara daito shoben ha-melech. Immediately the prince had Yishuv Hadas, a calming wave came over him. And he said, you know what? My father wants me to work to acquire that palace, to acquire that territory. My father understands that if he gives it to me too easily, I'm not going to appreciate it. And this long journey is ordered to arouse my excitement for that which lies in store for me. V'chein Yeshaya Amar concludes the Medrash. Similarly, the Navi Yeshaya spoke again the language of closeness. Ki karov yom Hashem. The day of the Lord, the day of Hashem is close. So is there a machlokas between Moshe Rabbeinu and Bilam? The reality is it has been a many, many years. It is a long period of time until Mashiach arrives. But it's a question of our perspective. Do I see Mashiach as being close, or do I see Mashiach as being far? Do I see all of the dates that we've passed as being a source of frustration? Again, in the 1200s, the 1300s, the 1400s, the predictions of 1860, of 1913, of 1940. I spent a year in Israel in the year 2000, Tavshin Samach. And there was such messianic fervor at the time. I remember walking into a Svarim store and seeing a little booklet that was printed explaining how different tzaddikim in earlier generations had offered the year 2000 as a critical turning point in world history. Something is going to happen, and there were predictions of Mashiach. And here we are 20 years later, and it hasn't come. So do we find ourselves being more frustrated than ever? Or do we find ourselves being more hopeful than ever? And I want to share with you a story as we wrap up just 5 more minutes. I want to share with you a story that captures these two emotions, these two feelings, these two perspectives perfectly. I mentioned earlier the Choza of Lublin, again, whose yard site is on Tisha B'Av. When the Choza of Lublin passed away, his son, Rav Yosela Turchiner, inherited many of his father's belongings. And the story is told that one time he was journeying with some of his Hasidim, and they came to a particular inn. It was a very cold, frozen night, and they stayed over at this inn. And unfortunately, Rav Yosela Turchiner didn't have enough money to pay for a night at this inn. So he said to the innkeeper, he said to him, listen, I can't pay you in cash. I simply don't have currency. I'm not able to pay you for my stay in the inn. But I have these wonderful possessions that I have from my father, the Choz of Lublin. If you'd like to take something from my Yerusha, one of these beautiful objects, you could take it in lieu of payment. So he helped himself. The innkeeper took as compensation, he took a beautiful clock that had belonged to the Choz of Lublin. Okay. And he hung it up on the wall in one of the rooms of his inn. Years later, there was a Talmud of the Choz of Lublin, Rabbi Yisachar Dov of Radishutz, the Radishutz Rav, the Saba Kadisha from Radishutz, as he was known. And he was traveling with some of his Hasidim. By then he had become a Rebbe in his own right. And he came to that same inn where the son of the Choz of Lublin had been traveling years earlier. And the Radishutzer came with his Hasidim, and they rented rooms by the inn, and the innkeeper assigned rooms to each of them. And it happened to be that the Radishutzer had a room that was right over the innkeeper's personal lodging place. And he said it was late at night, and he hears the Radishutzer walking around in his room, and he figures, you know, he's a big tzaddik, he's a big rabbi, he's probably learning late into the night. But as it got later and later and later, he just kept hearing these footsteps above his room. The Radishutzer was not settling down for the night. It was 12 o'clock, it was 1 a.m., it was 2 a.m., and he hears the tzaddik pacing back and forth, around the room. 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, the innkeeper can't sleep a wink. He hears his distinguished guest up above pacing frantically back and forth the whole night. He thinks maybe the bed isn't comfortable enough, maybe I need to bring him an extra pillow. Finally, the morning comes, and he sheepishly goes over to the Radishutzer's room. He knocks on the door, and he says, Rebbe, I have to apologize. I heard you pacing the whole night. It didn't seem to me that you slept a wink. I didn't sleep a wink either. I felt terrible, but I wasn't sure if I should come up to disturb you. I didn't know what was going on. Tell me, what happened? What was wrong? Is this your typical practice? And the Radishutzer looks at him with his fiery eyes, and he says to him, that clock on the wall, where did you get that clock? So he says, there was a fellow who was traveling a number of years ago, and he couldn't afford to pay. He couldn't pay for his stay at my inn. And he offered me the clock in lieu of compensation. So he says, tell me, who is the fellow? Tell me, what do you remember about him? And he's trying to recall his name. He's trying to say, and he starts to describe what he looked like. And he said, Yosela, maybe his name was Yosela. Maybe Yosela Turchiner. Yeah, that was his name. Yeah, that was his name. So he said, aha, I knew I've seen that clock before. The Radishutzer says, that was my Rebbe's clock. The Choz of Lublin's clock, the Seer of Lublin, the Holy Seer of Lublin, that was his clock. He said, let me tell you how I knew it was his clock. It wasn't just the appearance of the clock, the physical appearance of the clock. He said to the innkeeper, he said, you know, a clock, by definition, is a very sad instrument. A clock is a very depressing thing, especially, you know, an old clock that ticks and talks. He said, a clock is a very sad, the sound that a clock makes is a very sad sound. Because a clock, typically, with every tick of the clock, is declaring to a person, if you're listening carefully, another moment of your life has gone by. Another moment of your life has gone by. Another second is behind you. What did you accomplish? Look how much time has passed you by. Look how quickly life is passing you by. A clock can be a very sad and depressing instrument, said the holy Saba Kadisha of Radishutz. But then he turned to this fellow, to the innkeeper, and he said, but by the Choz of Lublin, it's hard for me to explain. It's hard to put it into words. But anyone who was in the presence, anyone who was in the court, the Hasidic court of the Choz of Lublin knew that the sound of the Choz of Lublin's clock was different. that with each passing second, the clock was declaring, you're a second closer to Mashiach. You're a second closer to Mashiach. You're a second closer to Mashiach. And my friends, that's the choice that we have to make. Looking back at Jewish history and looking at the very strange and unusual and unpredictable times in which we find ourselves at this very moment. Are we getting closer and closer, or are we just passing days by with greater frustration, wondering at the end of 2,000 years of Galus, is Mashiach ever actually going to come, Ribono Shel Olam? It's been 2,000 years since the Beis HaMikdash. I can look at all of these dates, all of these predictions throughout history, and become unbelievably frustrated. Or I could say, you know what? It didn't come in 1860. It didn't come in 1913. It didn't come in 1940. Again, all of these dates ended up being major turning points in world history. There's no question something was moving in the heavens at these particular times. But I could look at myself in the year 2020 and feel utterly frustrated that Mashiach hasn't come yet. Or I could say with each passing moment, with each passing Tisha B'Av, with each passing 3 weeks, when we thought last year, maybe this is going to be the last Tisha B'Av, and here we are facing that looming possibility of sitting on the ground of mourning again in a couple of weeks. Halavai it shouldn't be. Halavai it shouldn't be. But we have to ask ourselves, am I more frustrated than ever? Or am I more hopeful than ever? Knowing that for all those dates that passed, it's true they didn't, Mashiach didn't come. But we're that much closer right now. It's incumbent upon us, our job, and with this I'll conclude, our job is to continue to be hopeful. Our job is to not be frustrated by all of the indications in the world. How many of us thought this year on Pesach was going to feel a little bit different? How many of us felt that maybe this year on Pesach, as the coronavirus was taking over the world and HaKadosh Baruch Hu was forcing Jews back into their homes, just like it was at the actual Yetzias Mitzrayim of Jewish history. How many of us felt that this is going to be the year? And it came and it went. But we could say, you know what? We're one Pesach closer to Mashiach. We're one Shavuos closer to Mashiach. With each passing day, hear that tick and the tock of the Chozev Lublin's clock. Continue to long and continue to be hopeful. I leave you with a final source, the words of the Chafetz Chaim, as shared with Rabbi Shimon Schwab in Source 17. Rabbi Shimon Schwab is a young man in the year 1930, spent the Shabbos in the home of the Chafetz Chaim. And Rabbi Schwab Zatzal said that there were many conversations that he had with the Chafetz Chaim over that Shabbos. And at one point, the Chafetz Chaim posed the following question at the Shabbos table, Parshas Vayakel Pekude, 1930, Tuf Resh Tzadi, 3 years before the Chafetz Chaim passed away. He was one of the elders of the generation. He asked a young Rabbi Shimon Schwab, you know, a person who ate the man would think about what they wanted the man, that sacred, that holy food, to taste like, and the food would take on that flavor. Said the Chafetz Chaim to a young Rav Shimon Schwab, what would happen if you didn't think about the man? What would happen if you just ate the man without thinking about that steak or that salad or that ice cream that you enjoy? What would the man taste like? What was the default setting of the man, so to speak? And I would have said, if I was sitting at the table, if I would have had the guts to speak up, I would have said what the Torah says about the man. The Torah describes the man, right? As some type of sweet honey wafer, maybe. The Chafetz Chaim said to Rav Schwab, what do you think? And Rav Schwab writes, I was too afraid to answer. And the Chafetz Chaim said, if no one's going to answer, I'll tell you. And he writes where it's bolded in Source 17. Again, I'm sorry we didn't have more time to look at all of the sources. Ozamar, the Chafetz Chaim responded, Ani agid lachem, I will tell you. He said in Yiddish, "Oz mitrach nish hotes ken tamnish." If you don't think, my Yiddish isn't so good, I apologize, but I think what it means. If a person doesn't think, then the man doesn't taste like anything. If you don't put your mind into the man, then the man doesn't taste like anything. And then the Chafetz Chaim said a frightening thing. The Chafetz Chaim said, it's a spiritual entity. If you don't immerse your mind in spiritual things, they don't work. Spiritual things acquire their flavor in accordance with our mindfulness, our thoughtfulness. Said the Chafetz Chaim in conclusion, the same thing is true about Mashiach. If you don't think about Mashiach, if you don't long for Mashiach, if you just try to disengage and just say, whenever Mashiach comes, I'll be ready to greet Mashiach. Says the Chafetz Chaim, a terrifying thing. Mashiach will come and you will feel absolutely nothing. Our job is to not predict Mashiach. Our job is not to know exactly what it's going to be. But our job, again, going back to the Pasuk in Habakkuk that we started with, is to continue to long for Mashiach. To hear the tick and the tock of the Chozev of Lublin's clock. Not to be frustrated by the passage of time, but to be hopeful with each passing moment that we're another moment closer to Mashiach. So I bless us all. We should be reunited with the Beis HaMikdash this year. We should be zochet to return, those of us who are not in Eretz Yisrael, to come back to Eretz Yisrael all together. And halavai, we should continue to remain hopeful, strong, and continue to have those fervent beliefs of Mashiach's imminent arrival. Thank you all very much for your time. Again, I apologize for the technical difficulties at the beginning, and thank you very, very much for the opportunity to learn together today.